Taliban declared general amnesty for all government officials, urging them to return to work 2 days after taking power in Afghanistan. New Zealand announces a snap 3-day lockdown after recording its first case of locally transmitted COVID-19 in 6 months. And Japan plans to extend a state of emergency in Tokyo and other regions and widen curbs to 7 more provinces as COVID-19 cases spike nationwide. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A senior Taliban official says talks are underway in Qatar about a future Afghan government, including its name and structure. The Taliban's political deputy leader, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, said that the talks are taking place in Doha. He said Taliban delegates there are in contact with the international community and political parties within the country. Inside Afghanistan, the Taliban have declared a general amnesty for all government officials, urging them to return to work. The group took over Afghanistan on Sunday after it captured the capital. Kabul's takeover followed the capturing of other key cities by the Taliban in the course of a week. Military flights have resumed, evacuating foreign diplomats and civilians from the Afghan capital, Kabul. The resumption comes after Kabul airport was cleared of people desperate to flee the Taliban takeover of the capital. On Monday, the airport saw chaotic scenes in which U.S. forces fired at crowds to make way for American military transport planes to take off. At least 5 people died on the runway. The Taliban took control of Kabul on Sunday without a fight. Amin Alami is a correspondent who joins us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. I mean, at this point, are we looking at people returning to work as the Taliban have requested them to in order to see the country not be stopped in terms of its economy?
Well, of course, the Taliban are struggling to gain popularity among locals here. And I'm in the heart of the Afghan capital, Kabul. There is the residential place of former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, as well as some foreign embassies were located here. This street just heads to the Afghan presidential palace as well. Some other embassies, including the Turkish embassy and the Islamic Republic of Iran's embassy, are also located here. According to a statement released by the Iranian embassy, this political wing of Iran has resumed its operation, and that the Iranian embassy, along with its consulate offices, are open both here in Kabul and in western city of Iran that was captured by the Taliban almost 6 days ago. However, behind me there are dozens of people who are waiting to enter to this street and to ask for the visa of France, because the French embassy is also located here. But according to a statement that was released earlier by the French embassy, this embassy has stopped its operation here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, but the staff of the French embassy, including the French ambassador and some diplomats, are continuing their work inside the Kabul International Airport. However, the Taliban leadership and their military and other officials in Kabul widely call on the residents of capital to resume their daily life. For instance, they recently called on the Afghan women who were the employees of the Afghan government to return back to their offices and resume their work. The Taliban sources here say that they assured security and safety for all of the people here. But the presence of people, there are dozens of Afghan residents, Afghan people who are seeking for asylum abroad, proves that the people of Afghanistan are still worried and they are still concerned about the fate of their country, and even they are still about their own security and the security of their family members.
Have there been any instances that you have heard of where it involves security being, violated, or for people to experience any incidents with the Taliban that involves violence?
No. Since the Taliban took control over the Afghan capital, Kabul, the Taliban sources, mainly the military wings of this group in the Afghan capital say that we have seen no reports of bloodshed, clash, or war, not only inside the Afghan capital, Kabul, but across the entire country. But as I mentioned, it does not mean that the people of Afghanistan are properly or completely optimistic about their future. Just a few hours ago, a group of women and girls had gathered very close to United Nations Assistance Mission office here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, and they called on the Taliban to respect their rights, especially the rights such as education and some similar issues.
I want you to tell us what the Taliban have stated officially, that they, from what I understand, have said that the women can continue with their education. Maybe you could explain a little bit more how it views, the Taliban views on women are in Afghanistan.
They're ready to protect the rights of all people of Afghanistan, including women and girls, but they are insisting that they respect the rights of women and the people of Afghanistan in line with the Islamic values and as well as with the humanitarian values. They say that we are welcoming the presence of foreign embassies here, and we are trying to boost our bilateral relations, not only with the people of Afghanistan, but also with the regional countries. This comes as China has already insisted that we are going to establish a friendly relationship with the Taliban if they enter to Kabul peacefully. This has created optimism in this regard, that the Taliban will gain regional and international legitimacy if they continue to honor such values and such demands internally, and the demands coming from local, regional, and international players.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Amin Alami there from Kabul. The UK Prime Minister is recalling the country's parliament next week to debate the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, precipitated by the withdrawal of British and American troops. While some have called the withdrawal a massive foreign policy disaster, others have described it a betrayal of the Afghan people. Saeed Purizza has more from London.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union, you know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others. They brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Purizza, London.
Islamabad is cautious on recognizing the Taliban as the leaders of Afghanistan after the group recaptured the war-torn country with little resistance. Pakistan, which shares a 2,700-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, however, has reopened most of its border crossings with its neighboring country. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Afghanistan is now under the control of the Taliban, who are in a consultation process to form a new government. It remains unclear whether Taliban would include other ethnic groups in their rule or they would form their own exclusive government. The Taliban recaptured the whole Afghanistan, most of which without any resistance, after Afghan National Army surrendered to the group. Pakistan has assured visiting Afghan leaders that it would support an inclusive government representing all ethnic Afghan groups. Pakistan's National Security Council had an emergency meeting to review the impact of Taliban's takeover on Pakistan. Islamabad also discussed its options on whether or not to recognize the new government in Afghanistan.
Pakistan will not take any decision in haste about the recognition of new government. It will definitely take a collective decision, the decision which will be made by China, which will be made by Iran, which will be made by Russia. There are reports that China and Russia and other countries would recognize. Pakistan will immediately follow the step the moment China recognizes the new regime.
The Taliban's recapture of Afghanistan has shocked the world, given the lightning speed with which they took over the war-ravaged country even before the full withdrawal of US-led NATO forces. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has been critical of US for messing up with Afghanistan.
Mental enslavement is worse than physical enslavement. It is more difficult to break the shackles of enslavement of mind. But people in Afghanistan have broken the chains of mental enslavement by forcing the US to exit.
Pakistan is now dealing with the Taliban as a de facto government of Afghanistan, and that is why Islamabad has reopened almost all crossing points with Afghanistan, given the fact that there are tens of thousands of people who make back and forth movements on the both sides of the borders. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
As Palestinian children get back to school with the beginning of a new educational year in the Gaza Strip, a number of students have to stay at home because of the injuries that they sustained during Israel's recent onslaught on the impoverished enclave. Uva Shevet has more.
While the new educational year has started in the Gaza Strip, the 9-year-old Mohammed Shaban can't get back to school as he has lost his sight in an Israeli airstrike in Beit Lahia during the latest escalation over the Gaza Strip.
Today was the first day of the new educational year in Gaza, and Mohammed asked me to take him to school. I couldn't tell him that he can't go due to his injury. Mohammed used to do many things before he lost his sight. Now I try to help him play and move, but it is very hard. I remember when they hit our neighboring areas and I couldn't find Mohammed. I went to Gaza's main hospital and found him there. I was terrified because I thought he was killed. Mohammed lost his sight in that airstrike completely.
Mohammed was with his mother buying clothes when the Israeli airplanes hit them, causing his sight loss. He was supposed to return to school and buy a uniform like other children, but due to his injury, he is not attending the new semester as he needs special care.
Mohammed was in the market with his mother to buy clothes for aid when the Israeli airstrike targeted the market. He sustained injury in his eyes. I took him to Egypt to have surgery, but unfortunately, he lost his sight and there is no treatment for him. This is all because of the Israeli crimes against us. Human rights groups should hold the Israeli regime accountable for my son's misery.
During the Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip, more than 200 people were killed, including children and women. Hundreds of children were injured, including many who have lost their body organs, amid the silence of the international community.
During the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip, more than 60 Palestinian children were killed and almost 500 others injured. Israeli regime intends to target children and deprive them of their basic human rights. We call on the international communities to put Israel on the blacklist.
The last thing Mohammed had seen was the Israeli bombing that costed him his sight, depriving him and many other children from returning to school and causing them permanent disabilities. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Japan is set to expand its coronavirus restrictions as cases surge in the capital, Tokyo, and elsewhere. The curbs will include extending the state of emergency in the worst hit areas by nearly 2 weeks to September 12. The emergency restrictions will also expand to cover almost 60% of Japan's population. On Monday, Tokyo announced nearly 3,000 new infections in 24 hours. The city on Friday also registered a record high of around 5,800 daily cases. The new measures are expected to cost Japan's economy nearly $11 billion and claim 66,000 jobs. New Zealand has announced a snap nationwide lockdown after registering a single COVID case in 6 months. The authorities suspect the case is the Delta strain.
Delta has been called a game changer, and it is. It means we need to again go hard and early to stop the spread. We have seen what can happen elsewhere if we fail to get on top of it. We only get one chance. That's why Cabinet has...
The national lockdown will begin on Tuesday night for 3 days. Schools as well as businesses expect for the essential ones will be closed. The lockdown in the cities of Auckland and Coromandel will remain in place for a week. That is because officials say the Auckland case is not linked to the border. New Zealand has been praised for its coronavirus response. It has posted 26 deaths in a population of 5 million since the pandemic began. Rohingya refugees expelled from Myanmar in a bloody crackdown are to testify in court for the first time since Tuesday, or for the first time on Tuesday. The witnesses will testify remotely to a court in Argentina, which is invoking the principle of universal jurisdiction to file charges of genocide and crimes against humanity against Myanmar's leaders. The case is sought by a group of Rohingya refugees staying in camps in Bangladesh. The witnesses include five survivors of sexual violence in Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims escaped Myanmar in 2017 after a military campaign of rape, murder, and arson, which is believed to have killed thousands of civilians. Proceedings against Myanmar's leaders are also underway at the International Criminal Court and the UN's International Court of Justice. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 19th, 2018. 50 years after the passing away of the Prophet, everything changed. The name of Islam remained, the word Islam persisted. However, in reality, true Islam was no longer practiced. Instead of the government of justice, a government of oppression was established again. Instead of fraternity and equality, discrimination, division, and separation reigned. Instead of wisdom, ignorance ruled. During this period of 50 years, as we move on, we can find hundreds of examples of such cases. Researchers are recommended to elaborate on them for the young and investigative minds. Imamate was transformed into the kingdom. The essence of Imamate is contradictory to the essence of the kingdom. These two are contradictory. Imamate is moral and spiritual leadership, and compassionate and belief-related bonds with the people. Whereas a kingdom is ruling via coercion, power and deluding without any spiritual compassion and belief-related bonds. The two are binary opposites.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum.
أنا لاتشان Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Imamate is a movement among the Ummah, for the Ummah and in favor of rightfulness. A kingdom is an authoritarian dominance against the interests of the people, only serving particular classes of society to fulfill the ruling group's hoarding wealth and pleasing lust. What we see at the time of Imam Hussein's uprising is the second case, not the first one. That is, Yazid, who was in power then, had no relations with the people. He had no knowledge, no piety, no chastity, no experience of jihad for the cause of God, no belief in Islamic spirituality. His behavior was not a behavior of a believer in Islam. His words were not the words of a wise man. He was in no way similar to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. In this situation, an opportunity rose for a person like Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the Imam who was apt for succeeding the Prophet, peace be upon him, and he rose up. Looking at the surface of the events, this uprising was against the corrupt and unpopular regime of Yazid. However, beneath the surface, it is an uprising for the sake of Islamic values, understanding, faith, and dignity.
Venezuela's government and the opposition began a new round of talks to end a years-long political impasse and economic crisis in the Latin American country on Friday in Mexico City. The two sides signed a memorandum of understanding containing the roadmap that will guide the dialogue process. The dialogue is mediated by Norway and hosted by the Mexican government. The government of President Nicolas Maduro has called for the lifting of the sanctions imposed by the United States and Europe against Venezuelan officials and institutions. On the other hand, the opposition has demanded the government to release dozens of people it considers as political prisoners and provide guarantees that they can run in the regional elections due in November. In addition, they have requested the government to allow humanitarian aid, including COVID-19 vaccines, to enter the country. In 2019, the Venezuelan government abandoned talks that took place in Barbados and Norway after the U.S. stepped up sanctions against the Maduro administration. In 2016, the Vatican supported similar talks that also failed. Furthermore, the plan for recent talks ran into trouble when the government rejected one of the opposition's envoys. Representatives of President Maduro refused to take part in the meeting if the opposition leader Juan Guaido's ambassador to Washington remained on the delegation. Venezuela says the U.S. sanctions are responsible for the country's current economic crisis.
That is the number one issue facing Venezuelans, because the
sanctions are designed to break the Venezuelan economy and cause hunger on a mass scale. So if that can be challenged and pushed back even by a small bit, that would be incredibly important for all Venezuelan people. So I think these are fair parameters to go into the negotiations with. These are fair conditions, and the fact that the opposition is now coming to the negotiating table is a sign that they haven't got too many other options. This is, you know, after 2 years of trying to launch coups, calling for invasions, that they're now looking at the peaceful route is enormously positive, I think.
Washington and several of its Western allies have backed opposition leader Juan Guaido and imposed crippling sanctions on Venezuela in a bid to oust President Nicolas Maduro. The government says it won't bow down to what it calls blackmail by the United States in the upcoming talks. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. The United States has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, frozen millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro, while freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people, who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
Fierce clashes have been ongoing in recent weeks between Afghan government forces and the Taliban militant group. But the government troops haven't been able to keep the Taliban from making rapid advances across the country. In the past few weeks, the militant group has managed to capture half of the provincial capitals in Afghanistan, including the country's second largest city, Kandahar. According to estimates, the group is now in control of nearly two-thirds of the country.
Nobody with 75,000 troops or 100,000 troops can take over a whole country with practically no resistance and thousands and thousands and thousands of your so-called enemy just surrendering and saying, here, take the weapons, unless they have some kind of meaningful political support. So whatever has happened in Afghanistan over these years, we're not back at ground zero. There is a change in the political climate in the country.
U.S. intelligence officials are reportedly predicting that the Afghan capital, Kabul, will be isolated in a month and will be taken over in a matter of 90 days. In the meantime, the United States and Britain have urged their nationals to immediately leave Afghanistan, with Washington announcing it's temporarily deploying 3,000 U.S. troops to Kabul to help evacuate American citizens and diplomatic staff. The advances of the Taliban have led the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, to replace the country's army chief. The United Nations Secretary General has called on the Taliban militants to halt their offensive in Afghanistan.
I call on the Taliban to immediately halt the offensive and to negotiate in good faith in the interest of Afghanistan and its people. I hope that discussions in Doha, Qatar, between representatives of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the Taliban, supported by the region and the wider international community, will restore the best way to a negotiated settlement to the conflict.
Guterres warned that, quote, Afghanistan is spinning out of control. He told the reporters that seizing power through military force is a losing proposition that can only lead to prolonged civil war or the complete isolation of the country. He expressed concern over the early indications that the Taliban are imposing severe restrictions on human rights in the areas under their control. Guterres called on all parties to do more to protect civilians. His comments come as thousands of civilians are fleeing the violence across the country and seeking refuge in Kabul. The country's healthcare is also in bad shape, with health workers becoming overwhelmed as the number of people requiring medical attention has been on the rise. The U.S. is poised to withdraw all its combat troops from Afghanistan, ending its longest war in history by September 11th. That's despite the opposition from many American politicians who are saying it's doing so hastily.
We are doing what the British did for 100 years, trying to play these various peoples and games, one out off against each other, maintain Iran as the enemy, use Israel as our sort of fer de lance in the Middle East, support regimes from the 12th century, like Saudi Arabia. So sure, we hope Afghanistan becomes everybody else's problem.
The fact that the Taliban are seizing Afghan cities even before U.S. troops have officially left the country clearly shows that all funds the U.S. spent and all lives lost during the 20 years were for nothing.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales. But things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well, whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States is pressuring other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, another failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA. This simply isn't going to happen.
Iran is one of the few countries which has been able to produce vaccines against the deadly COVID virus. After a year of intensive research using all internal resources and expertise, Iran joined the handful of countries produced the coronavirus vaccine. The Ministry of Health later approved the Coviron Barakat vaccine that was jointly developed by Barakat Pharmaceutical Group and Shifa Pharmed Industrial Group. Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine has hit a production milestone of 5 million doses nearly a month after it was approved for emergency use in the country. Iran has accelerated its inoculation drive against the coronavirus since earlier this month, after the health ministry announced that it can rely on abundant supplies of foreign jabs as well as regular deliveries of vaccines that are being manufactured inside of Iran. The government says that it is determined to launch the production lot of domestic jabs, but stresses that vaccines must be imported from other countries to save people's lives. Knowledge-based companies, and especially those active in nanotechnology, are playing a major role in helping the vaccine production companies.
This is definitely an example of that, where U.S. sanctions once again have injured innocent people we remember back in the early part of the millennium when Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, was asked if the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children were worth U.S. sanctions. And she said, yes, it was. That's the U.S. attitude. The U.S. government does not care about the suffering of people.
Iran managed to produce vaccines despite being under cruel U.S. sanctions. The sanctions seriously undermined Iran's ability to battle the pandemic.
Iran could certainly have dealt with this, this pandemic much better than it was able to had the illegal and unjust sanctions not been issued. But Donald Trump issued them, violating international law and U.S. law by doing so when he violated the JCPOA. And the United States once again has blood on its hands, this time blood of innocent Iranians who would have been able to get the vaccine had the sanctions not existed.
The cruel and illegal sanctions denied Iran access to crucial raw material and necessary equipment.
A controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces, despite its neutrality in the Second World War. The 1943 conference at the Russian embassy is seen by many Iranians as a violation of Iran's sovereignty and independence. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif led a chorus of sharp criticism, describing the photo as, quote, extremely inappropriate. On Thursday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British and Russian envoys over the release of the picture online. The envoys were told at the ministry that the posting was totally unacceptable. The Russian and British diplomats insist that no harm was intended and that the picture was a tribute to the fight against Nazi Germany. Other Iranian officials and people were quick to denounce the photo. Iran's Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf censored the meeting between the Russian and UK ambassadors as, quote, inappropriate and inconsistent with diplomatic protocols, urging the foreign ministry to follow up on the case. Ghalibaf said both ambassadors must swiftly issue an official apology, otherwise firm diplomatic action will be necessary. Foreign Minister-designate Hossein Amir Abdullahian joined the chorus of critics on Thursday. The top diplomat said the picture, quote, showed disregard for diplomatic etiquette and the national pride of the Iranian people. Faced with widespread criticism, the Russian ambassador tweeted that the photo does not have any anti-Iranian context. The envoy said that he is not going to offend the feelings of the friendly Iranian people. The British ambassador retweeted his Russian counterpart's comments. The controversy triggered by the photo is still under the spotlight. Some observers believe an official apology could help end the controversy.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadidi, and you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. All of the answers, they are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet. Today, in our studio, we have our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher in the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our question today is how we as Muslims, Muslim parents, raise our children step by step. So if you could just give us an introduction to this whole matter.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. As we know that when it comes to teaching and learning, it's always a process. It's never one thing that you just shove in someone's brain and expect them to understand. Even as grown-ups, when we attend universities or schools or colleges, it's always a process. You begin from smaller topics, simpler topics, and then you make your way up
step by step until
you get it, you get to the aim or ultimate goal that you're trying to achieve. With kids, it's absolutely the same, and it's very vital. The mistake that a lot of parents make is that they expect their children to know things that they've learned themselves in 20, 30 years in a matter of a month or a week, and sometimes even in one sitting. Like the child does something wrong, and the father just comes and bursts all the information of the child and try to lecture him and expect the child to understand. This is nonsense. Children's brains are still fresh, they're still young.
They're still developing.
Developing, so it takes a long time. So the concept of step by step, it's even a Quranic concept. For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he says, وَاتَّبُوا خُطْوَاتِ الشَّيْطَانِ. Do not follow the steps or the footsteps of shaitan. Shaitan, it doesn't come straight away and says, you know what, let's go drink, let's go, you know, commit adultery.
Let's go be infidels.
Yeah, let's go kill people, or let's go have, you know, go
nightclubs. It's a gradual process.
Exactly. So shaitan begins with, you know, step by step. First, he says, you know, this idea might be good, you never know.
He tempts you at first.
Yeah, so it's like, think about it, let it in your head, and slowly, slowly, until you find yourself reaching. And this is how the Quran talks about things. With good things, is absolutely the same concept. You just have to reverse it. It's also a step by step. If I want to teach my child to be, for example, a charitable person, I'm not going to lecture him about charity and the benefits of charity and give
like
him
a 1 hour long lecture.
Yeah, and give him the hadith and ayat of charity and how Allah loves. No, he wouldn't understand this concept. For example, you walk in the street, you see a poor person, you give him, I don't know, a dollar or something, and say, go give it to this person. and he takes that dollar, he gives it to that person, and he automatically feels something in himself changing, right? He's like, oh, you know, that's a, I feel good giving and helping people. And slowly, slowly, you increase that in him until he gets to a stage in of his life, or, you know, as he progresses, he understands, okay, so giving is a good thing, this, that, and then you put the ayat and the hadith next to it, and makes a full picture. Right. So there has to be a step by step in teaching children. You can't just come and just try to give information that they will not be able to understand. And also you have to keep in mind as well the age of the child as well. So the age makes a huge difference. So if he's, like, for example, if he's 3 years old, the information that he requires is very minimum.
Yes.
And he requires, for example, more practical things. As he grows older, of course, you increase the information threshold and so on and so forth.
So basically be sensible. It is a child. He's developing.
Exactly.
It's got to be a gradual process.
Exactly. I give you an example of my own life. I remember with my father, because we come from an Arabic background, my father, when I was a kid, every time I do something wrong or stupid, I'm just being a child anyway.
Of course, yeah.
And my father, he just comes and he lectures me. He gives me like a very long lecture for like an hour.
It is probably a good lecture if you could understand it.
That's exactly what he said. He said, if I delivered these lectures to other people, they would have been ayatollahs by now.
Of course.
Right? So it's the process was wrong. That's all I have to say.
Dear Sayyid, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are going on break, unfortunately.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon him. I am a Muslim for all of time.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRB English Radio. We were just discussing Islamic upbringing, which is the name of our program, with our dear guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Sayyid was telling us that the process of raising a child must be a gradual process. Sayyid, please continue this very fruitful discussion.
We spoke about the concept that it's step by step, and it's a very logical, easy to understand, but sometimes applying the concept itself with parents, it seems to be hard, because most parents, they want something very quick. Like the child does something wrong and they lecture them and they want them to, you know, apply it quickly. Or they want to embed an idea in their children and they expect this idea to work immediately.
Humans are generally quite impatient.
Yeah, exactly. They're very impatient. And when you ask parents themselves, they say, no, obviously step by step makes sense and that's how we teach our children. But the reality is it's not. This is just... So the parents need to be very, very mindful of this method that requires a step by step. And like we said, I don't send my child to school to straight to grade 5 or grade 6. I put him in prep, and 2 years in a prep, and then year one, and he makes his way out. The same thing with upbringing, or especially with Islamic upbringing, because... a lot of the Islamic concepts require a lot of work, a lot of effort. Like I said with my example, with my story with my father, he always tried to lecture me as he's in the minbar, because he's a sayyid himself and he's a scholar and he lectures people.
Mm.
So when he talks to me, he's using the same method of lecturing, which wasn't very fruitful, to say the least.
No, of course not.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe the things he was saying, good things, but as a child, I had no idea what he was saying. And when he talks, my brain just shuts down anyway. Like, I got to Disneyland and Wonderland, and I just wander around, and then, I don't know, 45 minutes later, my father says, like, did you understand? I'm like, of course. Done.
of course not.
Of course not, in reality. So I move on, and I make the same mistakes again, and my father wonder why. I've lectured him. I've told him so many things.
I've tried so many times.
Exactly. Why isn't he learning? And I remember even times my father would write me like an essay, an Islamic essay of how to do the right thing. I'm like, I'm only like, what, 8, 9, 10, 11, 13. I don't understand these things. So sometimes as parents, we make that mistake. But if we go back to the hadith, for example, or we go to the traditions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam and Ahlul Bayt and how they dealt with their companions or with their followers and how the Quran talks to people, always uses that method. I mean, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduces the story of Adam in stages. And like, he doesn't go and just burst the whole thing. You know, like, he talks about their creation first and them making the mistake and then coming down to earth and then what happens. When he talks about Musa, for example, Allah could have told us in one chapter in the Quran the entire story of Musa. But he spread the entire surah across the Quran because, you know, lessons, you can't just take them all at once. It has to be a step by step.
Dear Sayyid, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are going on break, unfortunately.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRB English Radio. We were just discussing Islamic upbringing, which is the name of our program, with our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Sayyid was telling us that the process of raising a child must be a gradual process. Sayyid, please continue this very fruitful discussion.
This is what we need to keep in mind, that when we need to teach our children anything, be it, you know, simple or complicated or whatever it might be, it has to be a gradual step by step. That's how you make sure that your child ends up with the right ideology or that right mentality that you want him to be. Otherwise, we're not going to get much done. As we say, like with the fruits these days, they got so much fertilizers so much chemicals that they lose their taste.
Yes.
Because they,
you taste artificial.
Yeah, it's very artificial because it's just chemically induced. There's nothing in it. There's no flavor in it. Children are the same. When you're trying to shove so much information in their heads and you want them to be, obviously, a mini version of you, then they're not going to be very fruitful. They're not going to get back to society or anything. They won't learn much as well. And these concepts, as we grow older, most people ask this question. They say, well, I know it's haram. I know Allah is watching. I know I'm going to go to hell for it. Or I know Allah will question me. But I still do it. And the idea is, the answer is always is because you've learned a concept in your head. You never understood why. Or why you shouldn't do it. Or why it shouldn't be done.
There's a difference between understanding and knowing.
Yeah. So there's exactly. So there's a huge difference between just having an information in your head. And that's why even with us, even grown-ups, when we sin, we make mistakes. Is the idea is because most of these things we grew up with as concepts. We never understood the reality of them. But as you teach a child these things from a young age, practical with practical examples, and we mentioned in previous episodes of how we should introduce a topic to our children, for example, and how we should talk to them about it, and this has all been discussed. But the idea is that we're trying to push, and I think we overemphasize on this,
it has to be
gradual and has to be a step by step process.
Because it is a learning process, and for adults we have the same logic. In university or in every different subject, you start slowly and steadily before you go to the more advanced subject matter.
Exactly. So this is, like we said, this is something is very logical that we all do in life with anything, with everything. But sometimes, like I said, this is the mistake that a lot of parents make when it comes to teaching their kids.
Exactly.
That idea or that concept seems to disappear from their minds, completely disappears from their mind. For example, when they want to teach their kids truth or to help the poor, for example, or to pay zakah or to do salah or to do all these things. So a lot of parents, for example, they want their kids to pray at once. They teach them how to pray, the laws of prayer, how to do wudu, and then they say, okay. And when the kid doesn't do it, they're like, why? I taught him everything.
I taught him to pray five times a day. Why is he not doing it?
Yeah, so the idea is not that you didn't teach him. Yes, you did teach him, but he taught him all at once. For example, when I teach kids, usually when I teach them Quran or fiqh, I give them one concept every class. Like, I never, for example, if I want to talk about wudu, I'll talk about why wudu is important, and I leave it at that. Second day, for example, or second class, we talk about, for example, how to do wudu, just basic. Like, I don't have to emphasize on the fact that it has to be perfect from the hairline to the chin. you know, the finger width from the ear to this.
Very and,
you
relaxed.
Know, I'm like, you know what? You have to wash your face. How you wash it is up to you. That's it. So he understands that there's a washing of the face, washing of the hands, and wiping of the head and the feet. He understands
the concept now.
Exactly. And then you move on slowly, until you get him to perfect his wudu. But if I want him to be perfect from the first place, then obviously we're not going to go anywhere.
Dear Sayyidah, I must unfortunately interrupt you because our time for the program today is up, unfortunately. We will, however, continue the discussion, inshallah, in the future. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and we thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or just any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Qom, Iranian sacred city. Part 1.
Qom province, with an area of nearly 15,000 square kilometers, occupying less than 1% of the entire territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The province is linked to Tehran province in the north, to Sabeh, Tafresh, Ashtian, and Dilijan in Markazi province in the south. It lies to the southeast of Isfahan, and from the east to Kabir Valley and Namak Lake. About one-fifth of the province is covered with mountains and foothills, with the remaining four-fifths a large valley or basin. The holy city of Qom is situated in the center of the province, close to the surrounding towns of Salafjagan, Khalajistan, Kahak, and Jafariyeh. Given its historic structures, discoveries of artifacts, and the recordings of historical documents, Qom was a reputable and relatively large city in the pre-Islamic era. When Islam was introduced to Iran, Qom developed rapidly and became semi-autonomous during the sovereign reign of the Bani Umayyad and Bani Abbas caliphates. Qom is home to the heavenly court, the historic mausoleum and shrine of Hazrat Ma'sumeh, also known as Fatimeh Ma'sumeh, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazim, the seventh Imam of Shia Islam. Hazrat Ma'sumeh is revered by Muslims worldwide, and so her resting place being in Qom lifted the dignity and status of the city and conferred religious significance upon it. Among the other notable tourist attractions in the province are the holy Jamkaran Mosque and more than 400 other Imamzades, offspring of imams, shrines, seminaries, theological schools, historically important